Hi, my name is Bruce Bolger, and I'm founder of the Enterprise Engagement Alliance. And we're an organization founded in 2009 to help organizations benefit from a strategic and systematic approach to engaging all stakeholders in business. We're delighted today to have Bart Houlihan on the phone, or on the show. He's co-founder of B-Lab, which is a nonprofit organization dedicated to using the power of business to solve social and environmental problems. And they were founded, I think about 2007, Bart will tell us, way before the brouhaha about the concept of ESG and stakeholder capitalism. So I just want to quickly thank the organizations that help support these types of program. These are companies dedicated to organizations taking a strategic and systematic approach to people, and to remind everybody that we are stakeholder capitalists and give away a tremendous amount of our information with no financial obligation. It's a big open world there to help companies profit really from the same approach that total quality management brings to people management. So Bart, thanks so much. First, before we get into kind of the story of B-Lab, what do you think of the fact that the subject matter that you helped really start, you know, which is now being called stakeholder capitalism, somewhat related to ESG, but not exactly the same thing? What do you think that it's become a controversy?
Why do I think it's become a controversy?
No, what do you think that it, you know, what do you think of the fact that it has become one, and why?
Mostly I'm saddened by the fact that it has become controversial in a political talking point. And I think it's mostly politically expedient, Bruce. I think it is a touch cynical. And honestly, I think it's wrong on its merits. The arguments being made about stakeholder capitalism and ESG, fundamentally, I think it's wrongheaded. But it's opportunistic right now. It feeds into the culture wars that were experiencing across the United States right now, and it is an extension of those culture wars. And truthfully, that's not what sustainability is about. It's not what stakeholder capitalism is about. And so we're wrapping together and broadening the definition in a way that I think isn't true to what the whole intent is of sustainability and stakeholder capitalism. So I'm saddened and disappointed. I do think it's transitory, though, Bruce. I don't think this is a permanent state of affairs. I just think it's politically expedient right now while we're in a highly partisan world.
Well, and maybe part of the problem is that we haven't defined what it is, because aren't we conflating stakeholder capitalism with corporate social responsibility? When you founded, and this is a good transition to talking about B-Lab, and I followed you ever since, by the way. I go back to 1989 on this mission. So when you guys came around, I applauded it from my little humble perch. But you were out to change the world through business, right? not by taking money from shareholders to fund my pet political thing like a lot of people do today in capitalism, but rather to build wealth creation into business. So tell us about really how B-Lab and the whole concept of B Corp is not about taking money away from shareholders to fund your pet peeves.
Yeah, this isn't about tree hugging or anything like that. And the quick origin story of B-Lab. So importantly, Bruce, my background is not running nonprofits. I'm an entrepreneur. I ran an athletic footwear company with a team of folks called And One. It was a basketball footwear and apparel company that we ran for about 11 years. It was started with my college roommate, who was one of the original founders. He brought me in its first year, and we scaled that company up to be the second largest basketball company in the world. But what we did see, Bruce, is that number one, we had clarity through our time there that, frankly, in our opinion, business can be the most powerful man-made force in the world. And if harnessed appropriately, it can be a force for good. It can create value for the many instead of the few. But there's some structural challenges, as you're aware, that get in the way of companies that are trying to build societal value as well as shareholder value. And we felt that firsthand at AND1. AND1 was frankly, we would have never used the word socially responsible back then. We were just trying to sell basketball shoes to 18-year-old kids. But what we learned is if we did it in a way that took care of our employees, was built with a strong supply chain that was ethical and built on long-term relationships, where we were in and of a local community, and where, frankly, we were aware of our environmental footprint and managing it, it just made us a resilient business. It made us a stronger company. It allowed us to survive market fluctuations. And we saw that at AN1. We saw that fundamentally, by focusing on a broader set of stakeholders rather than just your shareholder, it built a better business. But simultaneously, it's really hard to maintain that commitment to stakeholders in the current structure. And when we sold the company, Bruce, when we got to the moment of liquidity after 11 years, by law, our only option was to talk about who was going to maximize the return to shareholders. And so at the moment that our legacy was most on the line, when the purpose and the mission of the organization was going to either be perpetuated or terminated, we couldn't even talk about that. And fundamentally, though I bear no ill will to the gentleman who bought it, he paid us absolutely fair price. Bruce, within, I don't know, 6 months of the sale of the company, he had eliminated our ethical supply chain. He got rid of all of our employees. He fired all 300 employees, got rid of all of our community projects, and he eliminated any efforts we had in trying to improve our environmental footprint, all within 6 months.
And what happened to the company?
It collapsed. It went from about $250 million in global revenues down to 40 in about 3 years' time. And so it, you know, it ripped the soul out of the business and lost its purpose. And in the process, the revenue base collapsed underneath it. And at the end of that, it just felt like, goodness, there has to be a way that a company can scale, raise capital, and even have a liquidity event and make sure its commitment to stakeholders can be preserved long-term. So that's what brought us to the idea of B-Lab, a better way for business, where fundamentally you're both creating real value for shareholders and creating a resilient business, and simultaneously, you're creating value for all of your stakeholders along the way.
Well, this is a really interesting question because, as you know, some of the legal scholars, Lucian Bebchuk, Roberto Tajarita, I believe I have his name correct, have basically said and argued that stakeholder capitalism is nonsense because at the end of the day, when you sell a company, all of the evidence is that nobody gives a hoot but anybody but the shareholders, and that just supporting exactly what you say.
Yep.
And that even though there are in 35 states statutes, which and also the Caremark statutes that you might be familiar with, that give you broad latitude to consider other stakeholders, most companies do not consider stakeholders. Yep. So how is B-Lab solving that problem?
So ultimately, there's a variety of things we're trying to do to solve that exact issue. One of which, Bruce, is that fundamentally, we believe that if we really want to make a transition from a shareholder capitalism to a stakeholder capitalism, we're going to need eventually different rules. That if the rule is to maximize return to shareholders, and that is the prevailing not only legal accountability, but also cultural expectation, it's going to be really hard to build stakeholder capitalism. And so one of the things that we've done, Bruce, is we've created a new legally recognized corporate form, something called the Benefit Corporation. And it fundamentally shifts fiduciary duty, where a company now is legally required to consider the impact of their decisions, not just on their shareholders, but on all of their stakeholders. And it shifts the purpose of the business, where the purpose now is, again, to create real value for shareholders, but also balance the interests of stakeholders. That legal change is a big deal. It upends shareholder primacy, and it really moves us towards a governance structure that supports the idea of stakeholder capitalism. So that is one of our efforts that we've taken over the course of the last 17 years. We've passed that legislation in, goodness, I think 54 jurisdictions now, 43 states here in the U.S.
But that includes Delaware, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's a biggie, as you well know.
So on Delaware, obviously, we intended to start with Delaware, and we quickly learned, Bruce, that we had to pass this in a variety of other states. And coming back to your first question about why I think this is somewhat politically expedient, this legislation was signed into law by Mike Pence, by Nikki Haley, by Bobby Jindal. It has been a completely apartisan effort, because in general, the idea of people harnessing the power of the private sector to create public benefit has not been a political football. And we passed that legislation here in the U.S., Bruce, more than 30 times unanimously, without a single vote in opposition. And so it's really important that I think people think somehow, and it's part of the media story, that this is something that's being driven from the left. And the idea of harnessing the private sector to solve some of our great challenges is something that we've seen globally can be embraced by both the right and the left.
Well, you're explaining why it's not getting any coverage while it's being, you see, because the media, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of press in the punditry. But you ask a typical CEO, have they ever heard of this? No. Barely know what ESG is. Nobody, the man on the street, even though it could transform their life, it could transform their jobs, it could transform customer service, it could transform community development. The man on the street doesn't think he or she has any power. And then finally, it doesn't generate clicks because there's no controversy. Yep. The right and the left, when they understand what it is, 90% of people, they're not asking capitalists to fork over money. We're saying there's a better way to make money. And we're going to go back to you now. But to me, again, I'm maybe even older than you. I lived, or I'm sorry, I don't mean even, but total quality management. It's very, very similar. Companies were forced, though, to do it by competition. And that's what's going to do it this time, competition. But let's get back to you. Yes, I'm very familiar. We had Judge Strine, who I know knows you, and you know each other very well. And of course, we spoke about, the statutes. But it seems to me that the nice thing about B-Lab, and then the amazing thing of getting 6,600 companies. I'm somebody in ISO, we're very involved with ISO, and I know how long and difficult it is to get people to do certification. So it's amazing what you've accomplished, So it seems to me that if a company, even under current corporate law, if they have a clear charter and they state to all of their investors and to their stakeholders that their charter is to make money and to enhance returns for investors by creating value for all of their stakeholders, and that when they make decisions, they will be addressing all of their interested parties to accomplish their profit goals. And if I'm following the B-Lab process, I technically do not have to become a B Corp, do I? If I want to still have a purpose?
Yeah, and then let's back up, make sure that we use, because we'll confuse your audience here. Like, there's two different things that's going on. So let me zoom out for a second and just provide context, and then we'll zoom back in. At the end of the day, you heard the story of AND1 and how I ended up at B-Lab. And pretty quickly, when we started B-Lab, we realized that, in fact, there was already a vibrant community of businesses globally that were really triple bottom line, sustainable, responsible, choose your buzzword. They were focused on something other than just creating private wealth. They were also trying to create value for all stakeholders. And in the process, they thought they were building a more resilient business. And so our focus at that juncture became really about economic systems change. It became a focus on trying to build an economy that just works better for everyone, one that is more inclusive, more equitable, and more regenerative, that really helps to address some of the world's great challenges. Bruce, we're believers in government at B-Lab. We're believers in the nonprofit sector. They are necessary but insufficient to address the challenges we all face. We've got to get business more engaged. And so that was our focus. How do we move the economy towards a more shared and durable prosperity for all? And what we ended up doing, Bruce, is believing in the power of leadership, that if we could find best-in-class companies across the globe in hundreds of industries, in dozens of geographies, that were demonstrating that this was just a better way to do business and creating value for all of their stakeholders. And if we shined a light on those companies, perhaps we could build a movement of people using business as a force for good, working towards that economic systems change. And our leaders, Bruce, and the reason why I wanted to pause, are something called certified B corporations. This is a corporate certification that looks at an entire company and certifies the company as one that's considering and providing value for all of its stakeholders. And the two things you got to do when you certify, you got to take and pass an impact assessment that evaluates everything that you do. And then secondly, you have to do that legal change where you fundamentally shift the legal framework of the company. Wow. where you're required to consider not just your shareholders, but balance the interest of stakeholders. You do those two things and you certify as a B corporation. As you mentioned, we have a little over 6,500 certified B corporations, 150 industries, 80 different countries.
Now that's where I'm confused.
Yeah.
How do I statutorily, can I do this in my corporate documents?
Yes.
Because in other words, all I really have to do is go to my lawyer and this is fantastic. This is exciting, viewers. This is important. In other words, I can literally, and you've probably supplied the language.
We do.
Where I go into my lawyer, I say, look, we have to update. And if you have, obviously, if you have shareholders, you got to get their consent.
Got to get shareholder vote. You bet.
And so it depends, Bruce,
upon how you're incorporated and where you're incorporated. And so, for example, the vast majority of companies in the United States, as you know, are LLCs.
Yep.
To do this as an LLC, you just rewrite your membership agreement. It's a paragraph that you insert. You get a vote for your members and you're done. If your partnership is similarly easy, go ahead.
Oh, well, please send it. I'd love to see if that's a non-proprietary.
Of course. It's on our website.
What is the essence of it? What is the essence of that change in the membership agreement?
It broadens fiduciary duty for the board and the executives so that they must consider the impact of their decision-making, not just on their shareholders, but all their stakeholders. And the idea behind that, Bruce, is to stop the externalization of costs and make companies consider all their stakeholders. Like, we're going to have to get off this road of trying to maximize the return to a very small group of shareholders, and in the process, pushing costs outside of the organization that the rest of us have to bear.
It doesn't work. That's not conservative. Is that conservative?
No. And in fact, it feels like something that everyone should get behind, because those costs end up being borne by
us.
Our government and us. Like, ultimately, the rest of us own that when that gets pushed outside the four walls of the business. And so that's what it does. It changes fiduciary duty so that the purpose of the business includes a balance. And coming back to your TQM example, that is at the heart of TQM. It's at the heart of any good business.
Deming talked about this. Yes. Deming in 1953, yep. The year I was born. So getting back to you again. It's from your standpoint, as having been a very successful, frankly, business person, congratulations. So in a sense, you don't think a company to be, quote, responsible needs to divert profits from shareholders. Could you explain? Because that's the number one argument that you're taking away. And then I'd like you to answer a second question. Isn't that what we're doing now? But go ahead.
Yeah. So quick answer is no, that this isn't, again, this isn't concessionary. This is building a better business. And Bruce, it depends upon your time horizon, right? Listen, if you're trying to flip a company in 3 months' time, I get that you might not be focused on all stakeholders. But any kind of reasonable time frame, companies do better when they consider the impact of all their stakeholders, when they consider and maintain a good worker relationship, when they're in and out of a local community, when they have a strong supply chain, when they're aware of the risks presented by the environmental crisis. Like, these are not, this is just a better way to do business fundamentally. And we have data, Bruce, that supports it, right? Like during the pandemic, when in the United States, one in six companies fail, right? It was among the most challenging economic environments that we've seen in a century. It was a once in a century global health crisis.
Of course.
Our community of certified B corporations had about a 5% attrition rate. 5%, that is multiple times better than what happened across the country. And they tell you that they were more resilient, not in spite of their commitment to workers, community, and the environment, but because of it. It builds stronger relationships. It creates better consumer involvement and repeat purchases. It strengthens your supply chain. It opens access to a bigger group of investors. It's just a better way to do business. And so I want to pause on that, Bruce. There's certainly companies that choose and tell their shareholders that I'm making trade-offs and I want to make these trade-offs. There are social enterprises that are for profit that are clearly saying, listen, I'm going to try to trade profitability for social impact. That's not what you and I are talking about right now. What we're talking about are businesses that fundamentally are trying to build a more resilient future for both themselves and for the country and the world.
And that's the difference for our viewers between a B-Lab certification, right, where I do not actually become a public benefits corporation, which is an exciting proposition, which I'll let you quickly explain. But in other words, if I'm, and I think you'll clarify, but if you're B-Lab certified, I've committed myself to these principles. They've been audited. I would imagine they're audited regularly. I probably pay a fee for that, but I get to put a logo on my website. And then, obviously, when the regulations that are coming from the corporate sustainability, from what's coming from Europe and even from the United States in terms of disclosures, being a B-Lab certified company, I suspect will kill two birds with one stone. Yeah. Because B-Lab certification, before we talk quickly about the Public Benefits Corporation, which is different, really what it involves all stakeholders. It's not just employees. You guys cover the customer, you cover the environment. So just tell us a little bit more about you've always had a stakeholder view in everything that you do, it seems.
We have. And so that impact assessment that we use for the certification, it's divided into five areas: consumers, workers, community, environment, and governance practices. So we look at everything the company does. And indeed, it has been about how you manage your stakeholders on all fronts. So that is the first effort or requirement of the certification. And Bruce, it's important that I provide clarity on this. The second requirement is that legal change. And some people, to do that legal change, have to become a benefit corporation. Because, for example, in Delaware, you can't just rewrite your articles of incorporation. It's against current corporate law. And so if you are a traditional corporation and you want to be certified by B-Lab and you have to do this legal change, you're not going to be able to drop a paragraph in. We'll require you to actually convert to a benefit corporation. And we'll talk more about that benefit course form in the center. But it's important. It's the combination of higher standards of social and environmental performance that are evidenced by the impact assessment that have been built to last through this legal change. And the legal change, as I said, is easy as an LLC. It's really easy as a partnership. As a corporation, it depends where you're incorporated.
As you mean, as a C corporation.
Correct.
Okay.
A traditional corporation, yes. Go ahead.
So we're going to talk about public benefits corporations in a minute because they're still allowed to make money, okay, obviously. But let me ask you this one last question related to a B-Lab corporation.
Yeah.
You know, again, the cynics say, in fact, you know, I have a couple of friends who just recently sold businesses for boatloads of money. Okay. Literally, one of them bought a boat and is sailing across the Atlantic right now on it. But he did care about his employees. He made sure that they got money. Okay. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, he did not have any control. And what happened was 6 months later, the company that he sold it to somebody else.
Yep.
Now, if he's a certified B-Lab corporation, and I don't want to get into the weeds on this, but I would imagine that could affect his valuation plus and minus when he's selling.
Totally.
Because if you're a B-Lab corporation, Well, tell us how a B Lab, you know, having a B Corporation is going to affect my valuation of my company and selling it quickly. I mean, yeah. I don't mean to, if you can give it, explain that quickly.
Yeah, quickly, not selling it quickly. Yes, yeah. Thank you for the clarification. So, yeah, that, like, fundamentally, there are multinationals that have whole strategies of buying certified B corporations. The reason being is that it is one of the best trust marks out there to provide clarity to the consumer set that indeed this company is a good business. It's walking the walk. And so we have seen organizations like Unilever. I think Unilever has now bought 11 certified B corporations. It was a fundamental strategy for the organization to find, buy certified B corporations and maintain their certification. There's such cynicism, Bruce, in the consumer set. They don't frankly always believe the claims of business, and we solved that problem. We're a third party certification that individuals can rely on as a trust mark that provides evidence that it's a good business. And so
that might help my multiple. In other words, if I'm selling to the right type of company, I could argue this is going to lower your risk. Yeah. They've done the due diligence for you. By maintaining my certification, you can be assured that there's less risk in buying me. So the right buyer might actually pay a higher multiple is the reasoning.
That we have seen that, Bruce. We've specifically seen that, and buyers have been more often than not interested in maintaining the certification post acquisition to continue to provide clarity to their stakeholders that the company has maintained its purpose. So yes.
And how does that affect the employees in terms of a liquidity event? Would that, you know, like my son worked for a company that sold out and he got a big check.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Now this company was screwed up. It went the same way as your company did, by the way, the exact same way within 2 years. No joke. There was a lot of talk, gone. Anyway, that's another story, but he got a payout. What does this mean, B Lab, in terms of protecting your stakeholders to a degree? I mean, look, capitalism is still a jungle.
Yeah, no. So we don't mandate employee ownership. We don't mandate employee options. We encourage it. And the way that we encourage it is it's included in the assessment. The assessment is a bar. You have to give above a certain bar. The bar is 80 points that you have to score on this assessment, right? And included in there is everything from ownership structure and employee options all the way across to, your environmental footprint through your supply chain, right? And the idea behind it is to try to encourage better practices for every company and that they continuously improve. And so coming back to your question, Bruce, we don't mandate that a company has to have an option plan or an ESOP for its workers. But we do mandate that the board and the executive team has to consider the impact of their decision in selling the company on their employees. And as a result, it more often than not results in better outcomes for those employees in the sale.
That's great. I'd love to introduce you to Lucian Bebchuk. I haven't met him either. Anyway, getting back to this sense, you know, we're a free country, right? We are a liberal. And, as a stakeholder capitalist, I think I'm one of the 300 people in the world who probably would actually call themselves that. I don't think a company has to be a stakeholder capitalist. They're free to be a shareholder capitalist, aren't they? As long as they follow the law, right? To me, why don't we let the free market decide? This whole idea of forcing companies, I don't think we need to force them. Don't you think the trends are in favor of the thinking behind the B Corp? Before we get, I want to go a little bit into the weeds on the Public Benefits Corp, but just in terms of what's driving the success of B Lab and the whole B Corp search, isn't it really investors, customers, and employees that are driving this? It's not woke, it's people.
No.
Tell me, what do you think?
It's not woke, it's just better business. It's people that are driving this. I couldn't agree more. And Bruce, I do believe that the trends are in our favor, that this embracing of sustainability and stakeholder capitalism is accelerating, despite the political blowback that we're hearing about right now. And I don't think that's going to change, because I do believe, Bruce, it's about risk mitigation. It's about managing your overall organization and not managing just to one outcome. And so as a result, I don't think this is, a trend that's going to end. Now, that being said, one place where you and I might differ, Bruce, and it's okay,
sure,
is that at the end of the day, this can be optional for an awfully long time. At some juncture, though, you're going to get to a free rider challenge, right, Bruce? Like, you're going to get to somebody who's using the fact that they are not, that they're externalizing all of their costs, that they're dumping the costs of their healthcare of their employees on society, that they're dumping their environmental costs on society, that if there is an arbitrage there in the free market, there is a group of people who will continue to take it. And so in my opinion, eventually we're going to have to change the rules. Doesn't need to be now. We have market forces heading in the right direction, but fundamentally we do honestly have a free rider problem that we need to be aware of. And that free rider problem you've seen over and over again in different markets. And it's essentially eliminating, we're going to have to eliminate that arbitrage eventually. It's not required.
Well, you know, the proof of what you're saying is in the environmental area. A friend of mine's dad owned a paper company. And at first he was totally against all the, he was a liberal, by the way, but he owned the company. It was coming out of his money. I lived it as a kid. I saw it. He was bitching and moaning. But I asked him 10 years later, you know, when I'd grown up, I said, "Oh, David, whatever happened to that?" He said, "It was the best thing that ever happened." "Oh, how so?" "Well, all the dirty players were put out of business, and the new equipment was far more efficient, and I made more money." So I'm not going to argue with that, but I will argue that it's not going to be necessary, I think, to make a lot of progress, even though progress is always slower than people want, and we'll get to that in a minute. I think your progress is actually pretty amazing, but we'll get to that in a second. But before that, let's get back to that public benefits corporation just for a minute, okay? So, folks, we've talked about the B Corp, okay, and that's a change in corporate language, et cetera, whatever. But what is the actual public benefits corporation, and what is the difference between that and a typical LLC?
Yeah. And so what we've done is we've used this community of certified B corporations to work with us to advocate for a new legally recognized corporate form, Bruce. It's called benefit corporation in some places. It's called a public benefit corporation in Delaware. It has different names around the world, Bruce. In France, it's called the Société à Mission. It depends upon where you are, what it is actually called. But what it fundamentally is it's a corporate form that changes fiduciary duty for the business, where the company is now legally accountable to balance the interests of shareholders and stakeholders. That's the most simple explanation of what it is. It upends shareholder primacy and changes fiduciary duty. The legislation has been passed, as I mentioned earlier, I think 54 times, 11 countries, 43 states. And it's a pretty big deal, right? It fundamentally disrupts shareholder primacy and current corporate law. Now, for your audience, if you want to be a public benefit corporation or a benefit corp in New York, you don't have to have anything to do with me. When you go to register your company with your Secretary of State, you can choose now. You can choose that I want to be a traditional corporation, I want to be an LLC, I want to be a partnership, I want to be a nonprofit, or I want to be a benefit corporation. And so it is a legal form that you can opt into on any of your online incorporation tools. You can just choose to become a benefit corporation. And it just sets you up with a different fiduciary duty.
Now, let's talk about that. Now, how many states can you now do that? Do you know offhand?
43.
Wow. By the way, folks, as someone who's lived all this, the accomplishments here are staggering, okay? To have accomplished something of that magnitude, really, Bart, you know, I'm surprised you haven't been on 60 Minutes. I'm not kidding. I don't understand how the media does not understand that this is life-changing work, but it's boring. I guess it's just what you've done is boring, Bart. Sorry. But anyway, getting back to this then. So what does that mean? Okay, I'm still able to make money. I can issue dividends. I can you know. So tell me, what's different in terms of a public benefits corporation?
It changes the conversation in the boardroom, Bruce. Like when you're considering, offshoring your factory, it doesn't prohibit you from doing that at all. It just means the conversation you have to have about that change includes what the impact will be on your local community where the factory currently is, on the workers who are part of that factory, on the environmental footprint, and whether the environmental regulation of where you're offshoring to is different or the same. It requires the board and the executive team to have that conversation. And ultimately, the board is required to balance that decision-making. And what's, again, really interesting, Bruce, is that I think if you talk to most CEOs, even if they're not public benefit corporations, they do that balance anyways. But what this does do, which is really critical, is it makes them legally accountable to creating, to having that balance, to considering those stakeholders. Because what we've seen over and over and over again, Bruce, is that when things get hard, and the business is having challenges, and the board, it is easy, as we've seen over decades, as you and I have watched, to jettison what you're trying to preserve for your stakeholders and really just focus on your legal accountability, which is to your shareholder. And so this just broadens that legal accountability to make sure at all times the company is having an honest conversation about balancing those stakeholder interests.
Well, I'll be a little more cynical and add that it's also safe harbor, isn't it, really?
It is.
There's a lot of shareholder litigation, and shareholders can argue under current corporate law, hey, wait a minute, what are you doing here? But this is really important, folks, because this is one of the really the most, the whole issue in running a company is really trade-offs. We make them all the time. And, you know, it's so interesting that the opponents of stakeholder capitalism somehow think that the shareholder focus eliminates trade-offs, when that is a sheer, obviously, these are lawyers who've never run a business, because you ran a business, right? You might have a labor union. You might even be in a place where the mafia is coming after you. And I've seen that in business, in the airport and in the air freight business. You could have customers that are pissed off at you. You could have lawsuits, and every day you're making decisions and trade-offs, and holy cow. And then I guess legally you can say, well, I made that trade-off based on what? Come on, we're really kidding ourselves. Yeah. So really, aren't we just really, when we talk about stakeholders, aren't we just saying, and this is what ISO does, by the way, and ISO came up with this around the same time you did, ironically, it's called NXSL, and it's a process built into all ISO standards, largely ignored by 80% of the companies that check off the box, you know that drill, but that basically says that any effort in an organization must be CEO-led and address the needs of all interested parties. That's the language.
That's stakeholder capitalism.
Yeah, right. And think of it. And it's better business, as you said. So anyway, so back to the public benefits corporation. So now, okay, all it really means is that it's a disclosure to all my stakeholders legally. Hey, when we're in that boardroom in the quiet of the room, you're going to hold us accountable to a discussion. I still may have to lay off people here, folks.
Yep.
But I'll explain why we laid off people. We'll do it in a humane way. We'll explain how it's part of our strategy. We'll explain how it's going to help those who remain. But you know what? I'm sorry, folks. From my language, shit happens in business.
Yeah.
We make mistakes.
Without question. And the legislation includes a few important things, Bruce, that I should provide a clarification for your audience. Number one, it requires a report. You're going to have to share annually, not only how you're doing financially, but whether you're truly balancing the interests of the stakeholders. So there's an annual report that is to the shareholders. Secondly, Bruce, this does not create what's called a third-party right of action. This doesn't allow, you know, Greenpeace to sue the company. This is about a covenant between the business and its shareholders, and the people who hold it accountable are the shareholders. And so the shareholders voted to convert to that benefit corporation structure, and they now have the ability to hold directors and executives for that balance, but it doesn't create, often people are really nervous that it's creating the opportunity to be sued by the general public. That is not the case. This is creating a agreement between the company and its shareholders. And then third and finally, there are no ability to have a monetary result of the litigation. It is the two things you can litigate over on this front are either to stop a company from doing something or requiring them to do something. So we're not trying to create a new set of specious lawsuits. This is very focused on trying to make sure that the executives and the board who have adopted this new framework are living into their obligations, they're transparent about it through a report, and the shareholders have the ability to hold them accountable in the event that they're not.
And you're making a good point, the shareholders. It doesn't change the fact that the shareholders, to all of you crazies out there who are concerned about this, it's not corporatism. The state does not own the company. You are still owned by your shareholders. So thank you so much for that explanation. So thank you so much for being good on your answers, because we're going to be great on the time. I don't want to put you on the spot. This is big news that has not yet been picked up in the U.S. It's really interesting, yeah. But I think you're aware of the new European Union Corporate Sustainability Directive, Reporting Directive. For those folks who have not heard about it yet, I think, and I want to get your opinion on this, so that's why I'm going to ask you about it. It could have as much impact in the U.S. as, and maybe more than, the GDPR, and which is, of course, the privacy rules, right? A lot of people are not familiar with the fact that the Europeans came up with this thing, GDPR. These are rules that require anyone with data from European people to protect them in certain ways. Well, a lot of U.S. companies had to adopt them because either they have data of employees in Europe in their, or they do business with companies that do, who ask them to comply, and it was just easier to comply even though they may not have to. Well, now we have the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, which has been approved, and it's going through the legislative process. Folks, for those of you who are geeks, and you know, and this may be why no one's talking about it yet, Bart, but companies are going to have to disclose what you are asking for.
Yes,
they are going to have to disclose how they treat their own workers, and even turnover. By the way, I love this one, Bart. They have to disclose their turnover. Now, I'm not one big on, I'm a libertarian, but this gets back to what you said earlier, okay? So you might just have to force people to do things. If you force people to do things, they often cheat. But I'm just reporting the facts. This is happening, whether anyone likes it or not, it is happening. So number two, and I'm going to ask you about this, they have to report not only on how they treat their own employees, but how their distribution partners and their supply chain treat their employees.
Yep.
They have to also talk, how do they treat their customers, down to how do they engage with them? What's their philosophy of writing instruction manuals? I'm not joking. The lawyers are going to love it. And that's why the lawyers are all talking about it, Bart. They're the only ones talking about it. It's not in the New York Times yet. But anyway, and then wrapping up, they have to talk about their communities. And it's all about disclosures, and it will be auditable. Okay, now this is not going to put B-Lab out of business, as you well know. If anything, it's just, and you know why they have done this? First off, it's going to apply eventually to companies with 250 employees. Starts with 500 employees, and it starts in 2024 for 2023. So let me ask you this, Bart. Am I dreaming this up, or do we have not quite a Y2K coming, but corporations, when they see what the heck this is, their eyes are going to pop. Am I wrong?
You're not, Bruce. What's interesting is there's three separate efforts about disclosure, one of which is the European Union's effort that you're just talking about. There's another one that's being developed by IFRS. And so for your audience who might be U.S.-based, IFRS is essentially the equivalent of the group that sets GAAP here in the U.S. It's the International Financial Reporting System. I don't know what the S stands for. In any case, it's how you report your financials globally. Well, IFRS has a similar initiative, Bruce, where they're going to require sustainability reporting. It's called the ISSB. And so they're coming up with their own requirements for corporations to report. The EU has a different set of requirements. And then third and finally, the SEC, as you probably know, is in the process of requiring some climate disclosure. And the truth is, Bruce, though our audience probably hasn't heard much about this, businesses that do that have material operations in Europe are quite concerned about this. Not about the disclosure, because many of them have been doing this disclosure for a long time through something called the Global Reporting Initiative. And so it's not going to come as a shock for them to be able to report. The challenge will be if they have three different reporting frameworks. That will be incredibly challenging for them. And so you're not wrong, Bruce, that there is a disclosure reckoning that is coming for business. And most businesses that I obviously talk to are aware this is coming and are trying to get prepared for it, because it will be regulated in Europe. And it remains to be seen whether it ends up being mandatory if you are IFRS compliant. And certainly you're going to have climate disclosures mandated by the SEC. That is all on its way. And fundamentally what this will do is it'll shine a light, right? This is about transparency. It doesn't come with requirements of minimum thresholds. It just shines a light and provides incremental detail for people to make decisions about businesses. It's a huge deal. And it'll fundamentally shift the same way that we, you know, decades ago got to a standard way of reporting our financials. And all of a sudden you were able to, right? Compare and contrast revenue growth, earnings per share, gross profit margins. You could see the financial performance of a company, and it led to an entire industry. That industry right now is coming into formation around sustainability. That's happening literally today with people building indexes and investment vehicles all around the idea of sustainability and managing risks. And with this disclosure, you're going to have the ability to truly benchmark where it's been incredibly difficult to date.
Yeah, and it's going to take another 3 years, but it's going to happen. Everything takes longer than people think, and those of us who hang in there are the ones that, benefit. We have a few more minutes, and I did want to talk about, obviously, this is being driven then, again, by the grassroots, though, at the end of the day. And that's why the free market, now, the Gen Z and millennials, more and more, and even older people, I think this whole segmentation of people is a little bit silly, but everybody said of my generation that we were the same thing that we say of Gen Z. But young people come with a fresh perspective and they want more meaning in their life. But you know what? The pandemic spread that mentality, right? It just made everybody go, wait a minute, what am I doing this for? What? Yeah. And for who? And and it made people individually intolerant of suffering for nothing. And whether that's permanent, we'll find out. But my point, getting back to your work, the driving forces of this, I think the real challenge is implementation now. It's not taught anywhere in schools. Schools are completely siloed, right? A stakeholder mindset, right? You either have it or you don't. And then what does that mean? Let me ask you, don't you really need to have a business operating system if you have a stakeholder mindset, right? Where you actually have a system in your organization? I only know of about 10% of companies that have even an informal business. They don't even know what it is, right? And it's a really simple thing. It's in TQM all the time, right? So don't we really fundamentally have an implementation challenge? Because companies don't even know what is stakeholder management, right? And then what does that mean? Do I have to invest some? No, it's really very simple. How do we overcome that? Or am I wrong?
So no, I would say genuinely across almost everything you said, I would agree with. Let's start, Bruce, with this move is stakeholder driven, and it's not coming out of nowhere. Like if we go back to 2019, Bruce, you might remember that the business roundtable came out with a statement about the new purpose of business.
Yeah.
Now, this is 181 of the largest companies in the United States and their CEOs. So Jeff Bezos, Tim Cook, Jamie Dimon, you know, literally the who's who of the CEO suite in the United States. And they came out with a declaration that they were no longer going to run their business exclusively for shareholders, that they were going to lead their businesses for all stakeholders. Fast forward to Davos in January of 2020, and Davos came out with the new Davos Manifesto. And that largely declared shareholder capitalism dead and that we were transitioning to stakeholder capitalism. So this has been in the works, though I know many people are just coming to it now. It's been in the works for decades. And it largely has been driven by an awareness and an awakening to the business risk of the climate crisis and a growing unrest from folks about the broadening disparity of wealth. The combination has put real pressure on business leaders to address this. And so you're not wrong. And where we see it showing up for our work is the first place that people use our intellectual property when they become a certified B Corporation is on their HR listings. It's to attract and retain talent. When I talk to traditional business people about, hey, listen, this is gonna help you sell more to your consumers. It's gonna create a more loyal supply chain. It's gonna create greater access to investors. There's skepticism, but when I say this is going to help you attract and retain the next generation of talent, they all pay attention. And so what you said about millennials and Gen Z and what they expect out of work and how that has accelerated in the last 3 years is wildly true. Like the data is off the charts that those folks are looking for both money and meaning in their work. And they will make trade-offs. They will do trade-offs between purpose and capital. And so this is ultimately business, as you know, Bruce, is a race for talent. This is fundamentally a talent acquisition strategy as much as anything. And so,
well, it's a customer acquisition and an investor acquisition. Customers, they're making, I hear it my daughters when they're talking, they will make decisions based on, oh, I heard that company like Tesla. I know they've lost business. Yep. I've heard it. I've said, nope, I'm done. And that I'm not going to see whether that's right or wrong. That's just the way it is. So given the limited
I want to come back. Yes, well, last question. I don't want to lose the idea of the operating system because it's important.
Good, great, please.
When we started this work, and still today, the first question I get, Bruce, is like, yeah, I want to be on this journey towards stakeholder capitalism, but I don't know where to start. I don't know how to get going. One of the things that we've done, Bruce, is the impact assessment that we have that we use for the certification. It's a public good. Anybody can use it. It's a do-it-yourself consulting tool that essentially gives you a roadmap.
Great.
Towards stakeholder capitalism. We have now about 250,000 companies that use that tool. We had 50,000 companies a year who use that tool again, completely for free. And so if there are business leaders in our audience and they're wondering where to start, I don't get anything from it. It's simply a public good to help you on this pathway towards stakeholder capitalism.
That's our model.
It is fundamentally an operating system. Coming back to
that's our model too. So send it to me, please, after this, and we'll include it in the feature article, folks. There'll be an article about this. People will be able to access for the coming years on our library. So obviously, implementation is the key. Have you done any work in the academic world? Have you done anything with universities to try to get professors to teach this?
We have over 500 universities across the globe that teach about B Corporations and benefit corporations. It absolutely needs to be embedded into both law schools and business schools as part of the training. And so, you know, frankly, what's been fun, Bruce, is I taught Duke last week. I have Wharton coming up in 2 weeks' time. We do a lot of work with our nation's great university system to try to make sure, and what you brought up earlier is exactly right. This is being demanded by the students. And frankly, the administration is aware the hardest group to change, understandably, is professors. They've created an entire, literally, library of academic research based upon the old model. And this is a shift, as we're talking about, to a new model. And as a result, they've been harder to bring along, but it's definitely happening, whether it be Harvard Business School or Stanford Business School or Wharton or Kellogg. This has been absolutely part of the curriculum now, and it's encouraging.
Oh, that is encouraging because, as you know, they're the most siloed medieval institution in the world.
Academia. Students are demanding. Yeah,
it's incredible. So once again, that's a testimony, and you're a humble man, but you to your incredible accomplishments. So wrapping up, how optimistic do you think that in 3 years, it will not, like if you say to somebody, stakeholder capitalism, not only will they understand it, but even say, yeah, our company is moving in that direction, we're B-Lab, whatever. How optimistic that within 3 years we are going to see real progress? Because I've been at it since 1989, and I would not call it a rapid change.
Yeah, I think this is generational, Bruce. I think 3 years is a tight time frame to measure anything. Yep. And we're talking about a fundamental shift of the capital system, and that's going to take time. And there are signs, I would say, Bruce, that give me great hope, whether it be the passage of legislation in 11 countries and 43 states, whether it be 50,000 new companies using our tool annually. I'll tell you a quick story to wrap up here. When we went into the pandemic, when B-Lab entered into the pandemic back in March 2020, I made a pretty significant error. And my error was I thought this was going to be cataclysmic for our effort. I thought businesses would focus just on keeping their doors
survival.
Open and survive, and that they would, I thought our submissions for certification would evaporate. I thought the pipeline would evaporate. And I thought there would be an enormous attrition rate because you're right, Bruce, to be certified, you got to pay us an annual fee. And I thought people would say, listen, I love you guys, but honestly, I got to conserve every dollar right now because I'm facing truly a once in a 100-year threat that I've never seen before. And so we cut budget, we put a hiring freeze in place, and we just went to the bunkers waiting for the other shoe to drop. And the exact opposite happened, Bruce. We went into the pandemic with about 3,000 B corporations. And the 2 years of the heart of the pandemic, 6,000 companies applied for certification. I got to 3,000 after 14 years, and in 24 months, we were looking at a backlog of 6,000 companies who had applied for certification.
That's astounding.
It was astounding, and it is exactly what you're talking to. I think the pandemic created a reckoning for folks to try to reevaluate what the purpose of business is and what they're trying to do as a business leader. And we were not the only ones who saw that enormous surge. Others working in this space of sustainability, of stakeholder capitalism, saw a similar acceleration during that time frame. And so I'm actually pretty hopeful. I think the ESG woke capitalism blowback is temporary. And as I mentioned, I think it's cynical, and I think it misses the point that ultimately this is just better business. This is building more resilient businesses. And ultimately, I think that'll come around. I also think there's also some blowback from the other side.
Yep,
there is. The fact, right, Bruce, that 95% of U.S. securities are in some sustainability fund. That's kind of crazy. I think you and I both would know that 95% of U.S. securities shouldn't be in a sustainability fund.
Absolutely.
So there's pressure coming on both ends, but I'm pretty optimistic we're headed in the right direction.
Well, one last thing. I'm going to give you an opportunity for a plug because I'm a big believer in you. So what does it cost for a company? I would imagine you do skew it for smaller businesses versus larger businesses. So just give us a range of what's involved with getting a B-Lab certification.
So if you were, and I'm going to assume these are U.S. businesses, Bruce, because yep. We also differ by.
Well, we have readers all over the world, but okay. Let's just stay on the U.S.
So in all over the world, like we go as low as $1,000 a year for a small company in an emerging market. It's $2,000 here in the U.S. And so
Wow. Cost
is not intended to be the barrier. The barrier is it's hard. It's hard to do. It's hard to take and pass the test. It's hard to do the legal framework. It's intentionally difficult because coming back to where we started, Bruce, The whole idea behind the certification is to find leaders who lead a broader movement of companies who are inspired by them. So whether it's Patagonia or the Guardian newspaper out of London or Natura Cosmetics out of Brazil, like those companies inspire others to learn more about stakeholder capitalism and begin the journey. And so the certification is challenging. It's not going to be about the check you send us. That's not the barrier to entry. It's intentionally trying to find leaders of this new way to do business.
And I would imagine that the auditors are provided by B-Lab.
Yes. Yeah, we do. That's including the verification fees. Obviously, importantly, Bruce, when you go up to multi-billion, we have multinationals who are engaged as well. That cost can be north of $250,000, right? But it's staged based upon the size of business. And it's never supposed to be, price is never supposed to be the barrier to entry.
Well, Bart, thank you so much for your time today. We'll be writing about this and sharing this for the next year. And great work. Congratulations on only another entrepreneur in this issue, in this world, could know what you've accomplished as well as I can. Take care.
You too.